may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. It's season 2 of Torah Pills. I'm Jono, and joining me in the virtual Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
Good morning and good evening and whatever else time it is for the people listening.
Because you're right on the border of both of those, it's midnight where you are.
It is.
And joining us from Louisiana, where it's a comfortable 6 p.m., Russ Nichols of rootsoffaith.org, Ancient Truth for a Modern World. G'day, mate.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing pretty well. Doing fine. So, Russ, what's news? You've just come back from the United Israel Conference. Is that right?
That's right. I just got back. We had a lovely meeting. This is we're beginning the 72nd year of this organization, United Israel World Union. The website is unitedisrael.org. We had a wonderful meeting. James Tabor was there. Obviously, he's the president, and we had 4 lectures on Saturday. They really were, I think they were good, and all of those are up on the website, so we're looking forward to people's comments. We were able to webcast it live, so it was a great time. You know, it's great anytime you can get people together, and good turnout, very, very fun. Had a great time. I'm back and ready to do this Kiddushim now.
That's where we're up to. Now, just in case, for those who don't know who James Tabor is, we've had him on the program a couple of times. We're looking forward to having him again sometime in the future. But we were plugging the books Paul and Jesus, which is just such an exceptional book. You can find that on Truth to You, and you can get the book from his website, which is jamestabor.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
That is, and also Restoring Abrahamic Faith is the other book that we were talking about, which is another one of James's, just 2 out of 7 or 8 that he's written, which are available from his website. Now, Kedoshim. Hang on, what's going on in Spiritual Babies Land, Jason?
Oh, at the moment, I'm actually pre-recording a series with Rabbi Federo on Jonah. So we're going through Jonah and having a look at some of the themes there, and that's proven to be interesting. And also, every week I'm doing a half Torah show with Rabbi Neely. So for those of you that like the Torah Pals, if you're interested in what the prophets have to say, you can head over to my YouTube channel, and we do the half Torah in half an hour, and we go and have a look at the... A lot of the shows that I do tend to have kind of a New Testament argument in them in some form, but this is not that. This is the Jewish look and the Judaism's teaching on the Haftarah. So people can go over there. That's all free and have some fun there.
Brilliant.
Wait a minute, guys. Before we get into this, speaking of Jason Spiritual Babies, are you completely on the bus yet? I have been thinking about this all week. How close are you?
I'm about 2/3. My butt and my legs are on the bus.
And the rest of you is just dragging along. Though that's pretty gruesome to think about.
I'm gripping on. It'd be awesome if I could get my arms and my head on the bus too. But so far, my butt and my legs. Everyone, I have to say, anyone that's listening that has helped and donated and supported me in this adventure to get on this bus so I can record this trip for everybody, thank you very much. And for those that have offered their support by sharing the link to the fundraiser site and by praying and by word of mouth, I really appreciate that too. Everyone's been very supportive. And you know, in general, the friends that we have on the internet that we haven't met, that blows me away. Our internet family, our extended internet family, are very grateful for everyone that we get to speak to. And super grateful for all the help that we get. So, you know, on behalf of Spiritual Babies, and I'm sure Roots of Faith and Truth to You, because we all have this massive internet family, I just want to thank everyone for all the help that they give us.
Well, I want to encourage people to help you, though, Jason. I mean, you do a lot for people, and one of the things that I think is important, not only because I enjoy hearing your voice, but I'd like to meet you, all of you, the whole body, on the bus, and you know, like you said, you're going to do everything you can to help people experience this tour if they're unable to go. So you mentioned, you know, people can pray for you and so forth, but those that can afford to help, you know, just a little bit goes a long way if people will contribute as they're able. I think that would be great. I'd love to meet you, and I think it would be a great trip without you, but it'd be even greater with you. So
So just to bring everybody up to speed, we are, of course, going on tour. Ross, myself, and Tovia are going on tour in Israel November the 2nd. There are 9 seats left, or maybe there's 9.5.
Yeah.
9 seats. There are 9 seats left, and we're going in November, people, so there's plenty of time, but those seats are going quickly. So if you would like to secure your place with us on that tour, you need to go to truthtoyou.org. You'll see the links there, Israel Tour 2015. Click on those links and just follow the prompts there, and you can leave a deposit to secure your place on the tour. We would love to see you there, but there's only limited seats left. And what I'll do, Jason, give me the link, and I'll put this the link on this post, whereby people who can't come with us but would like to follow your documentation of the tour and would like to contribute to getting you there, all of you on the bus, we'll put that link on this post as well, so that people can do that. Because I understand that you are planning to bring some rather fancy technology to do exactly that, to document the tour, to photograph the tour, to record, video the tour, and make some programs available to the people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a few gadgets that I really need to get to make this. I mean, it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And it's your
first time there.
Yeah, it is. And for many people who haven't been before, or who have just kind of started this walk, it's also going to be the first time they get to see their Facebook buddies in the land too. And I want to make sure that experience is as crisp and tangible as possible. So I want them to be able to hear it, and I want them to be able to see it, and I want them to be able to smell the falafel.
I can't guarantee
this, the falafel smelling part, but I want to make sure that everything's as good as possible. And just for the people that are considering whether they want to get on this bus, this is a Tanakh-only tour, and that might sound instantly like it's a big study tour, but this is going to be an immersive tour. I mean, imagine you go onto YouTube and you find a 5-minute high-definition IMAX video of a helicopter sweeping through Israel. How cool that would be. But then imagine how if it was you, you're standing in the land, on the soil, where it happened, and you're reading in the text. And you're not reading in the text and wondering, I wonder what it looked like, because you're there. And Tovia will be there, and Ross will be there, and Jono will be there, and a whole bus full of people who are like-minded people, and we get to spend 10 days in the land, eating the food, breathing the air, swimming in the water, and the text in your Tanakh will come alive. It will be a life-changing experience. And one that everyone, if they can, should definitely sign up for.
We're going to be walking where kings and prophets walk. Think about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't underestimate the power, like you're saying, Jason, of actually seeing the land. Most of the listeners have read scripture all their life, but to actually touch the soil, to feel the rocks, to breathe the air. This is the land that God's eyes are upon from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, it says in Deuteronomy. So I really encourage, I mean, people spend a lot of money to go on vacation, but not like this. This is totally different. So join us. You got to join us.
Join us. Please come. There's only 9 seats left, so you've got to be quick. Leave a deposit. Truth2u.org. Truth2u.org is where you can do that. If you would like to come but you can't come, then help get all of Jason on the bus. It'd be a terrible mess to have to drag him around. and we don't want that sort of publicity. And you can do that by clicking on the link on this post. Kedoshim is where we are, and it kicks off this way. Now, in my New King James, fellas, it has a little subheading, and it says moral and ceremonial laws. Oh. The first thing that goes through my head when I read that is I remember struggling, and perhaps you guys had a similar experience, trying to figure out what are the laws that we're supposed to keep on keeping when we were in the Christian tradition,
right?
And what are the laws that we're not supposed to keep anymore, because that would be evil, as is the way with the Christian theology.
Done away with, abrogated.
Done away with. Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Which are those? And the answer would often come back to me saying, well, the moral laws are the ones that you keep, and the ceremonial laws are the ones that have been done away with. They're the ones that have become obsolete. Okay, well, which ones are they, and which ones are the moral laws? And that's where it starts to get cloudy, and that's when people like to stop talking about it. Mm. Usually people will say, well, you know, the moral laws, you know, like the Ten Commandments. Mm. Well, then why don't we keep the Sabbath anymore? And that's the end of that conversation. So
that's kind of interesting, too, because the text, from my experience, most of the moral laws don't end with this will be a permanent statute. Most of the permanent statutes are the physical things that you do. They're mm-hmm. not the spiritual things that you do. So for the physical things that you do to be permanent and everlasting statutes, and for them to be the things you're not supposed to do anymore, doesn't make any sense. And something that struck me the other day is that someone said to me in a forum that Jesus is the living Torah. And they said that the Torah wasn't nailed to the cross. That just confused me a lot. I will jump in and say, God, that's going to get me so much grief. it's worth mentioning that Kiddushim is the middle passage, the middle Torah portion of Leviticus, and it's also bang smack in the middle of all of the Torah portions. So the last time we were on with Ross, and he mentioned the middle word of the Torah, but here we are in the middle, the more middle Torah portion.
All right, Russ, I'm confused. Can you help me out there? What's going on?
Yeah, we're talking. Isn't it interesting that Kiddushim, which means holiness, is the very center of the Torah, according to Jason? You have to count these up and make sure he's right. Kiddushim, holiness, in the middle of the Torah. Well, what he's referencing, when I was on last time, I mentioned that the center of the Torah, you know, if you look at the scribal notes in the Hebrew, it records, the rabbis record that Leviticus chapter 10, verse 16, in the Hebrew it says, Darosh Darosh. Moses is seeking a sin offering. And so the very heart of the Torah, the center word is repeated twice for emphasis. And it means to seek. So in other words, the heart of the Torah is in the search. How many of our listeners can relate to that? It really represents the heart. If you diligently seek Hashem and his ways, that's the heart.
All right. Well, this is the way that it begins. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy.
Whoa. I just want to jump in here real quick. I know Ross is going to have some cool stuff, but I want to get in there first in case he usurps my information. So the text says, you should be holy, for I, the Lord God, am holy. And so we have to wonder, how are we to be holy like God can be holy? We can never be as holy as God. What does God want from us in this passage? And what it struck me as I was going through the rest of the Torah portion is that this is an instruction manual of what God wants from us. So when he says you should be holy as I am holy, he has given us over the next few pages a list of ways we can be holy as he is holy. So in the beginning of the Torah, God forgives Adam and Eve. I mean, they're punished for their sin against the tree, but he forgives them and he clothes them, and they still have a life and children and offspring. He deals with Moses' death in a kind way and looks after the old and the aged. And he does a whole load of good things for bad people, and he feeds people and he saves people from physical pain, even sometimes non-Israelites. You know, we get plenty of stories in the whole of our Tanakh of foreigners, if you like, that do the right thing or are saved from a certain situation. But moreover, when we go through these passages, we're going to see how to treat our peers, how to treat the elderly in our community, how to treat the stranger, how to treat poor people, how to treat people that are worse off than us, not just in a way that shows that we should be, I don't know, condescending or kind of like an ego boost that we're able to do something for someone that can't do it for themselves, but in a way that says, this is your brother, this is another human being, you are my people, I've set you apart, you aren't better or worse than anybody else, and you, I want to act holy as I've acted holy towards you. As we go through, not to look at this as maybe what God says to Israel, but what God wants from, I think, everybody.
So, Ross, yeah. At this point, before we move on, we should probably define the word holy. How can we define it?
I was going to say holiness. You know, typically when you look it up in a dictionary, you get the root meaning of kadosh is to be set apart, to be holy. Mm-hmm. And so that's the basic understanding. But as Jason pointed out, as we work through, because that's a book definition. So you say, okay, well, I know what the word means, but what does it mean? Like, how do you define holiness in your daily walk? And that's what we're going to get into. If we could stay here for just a minute, you know, I was thinking about, you know how Tovia starts his show, Holy Jews and Gentiles.
Yes.
I love that. And I think that goes with Jason's points. That was a pretty good impersonation, wasn't it?
That was pretty good.
but I like that idea because holiness, you know, how many times when I grew up in Christianity, I was told, you know, there was one holy and it's not you, Ross. You know, you're not holy. But but the Bible actually, it's not only said that we can be holy, but this is a direct command. Be holy because I'm holy. And, you know, we know that God is holy. In fact, the most common way to refer to God in rabbinic literature and so forth, you've heard this and seen it in prayers, Holy One, blessed is He. But this takes us to a whole new level, a W-H-O-L-E, whole new level, in that we're commanded to be holy. You know, Israel's commanded in Exodus chapter 19, verse 5 and 6. You are to be a holy nation. I think that's quite incredible. And to Jason's point, that's what we're going to see here. We're going to find out what it is that we're to do to be holy, as Tovia says, holy Jews and Gentiles.
So it kicks off with a couple of, it reiterates some of the commandments in the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, verse 3 of Leviticus chapter 19. Every one of you shall revere his mother and his father and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Well, there's the fourth and the fifth commandment. Verse 4, do not turn to idols nor make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God. That's the second commandment. And if you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it of your own free will. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it and on the next day. And if any remains until the third day, it shall be burned in the fire. And if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an abomination.
So I am the Lord turns up 16 times in this chapter. It's a bullet point underneath each one. And what I constantly remember when I read this is, you shall be holy, for I am holy. So when I read, for example, when I read, you shall fear every man his mother, it's quite interesting that it's fear in this one and it's honor in the other version. And in this one as well, mother comes before the father. There's a lot to do in there as well, but I get people should go and study that out themselves. You shall keep my Sabbaths. And why were they placed together? You know, why the mother and the father and you shall keep my Sabbaths? Why isn't you shall keep my Sabbaths a separate thing? Because question. You are honoring and fearing your parents, but above that, you're honoring and fearing your God. And when I read, I am the Lord your God underneath, what it's really saying is, I am holy, you have to be holy, and that's why I'm asking you to do this. And another really cool thing there is turn that onto idols. It doesn't say idols. It says nonsense things or invisible things, things of no tangibility, if that's a word. that's kind of cool as well, because we read it and we think that God's telling us there not to carry around little wooden symbols. But what he's really saying is don't place your faith in anything that doesn't have, you know, don't place your faith in anything except for me, I guess.
Yeah, to your point. By the way, Jason, you woke up pretty well there. Look at him. He's wide awake. Yeah. No, but you bring up something interesting, Jonah, when you say that this is very similar. You know, it comes across as almost a repetition of the 10 words. In fact, I was looking at Hertz's commentary, and he says, this remarkable chapter, talking about 19, occupies a central position in Leviticus and therefore in the Pentateuch. The rabbis rightly regarded it as the kernel of the law and declared that the essentials of the Torah are summarized therein. And then he goes in to show how all of the 10 words are found at some place within this chapter. So that's quite remarkable. It's a repetition, if you will. Maybe an expounding.
and expounding off. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your fields, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, and you shall not glean your vineyards, nor shall you gather every grape for your of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. Mm. I am the Lord your God. That's beautiful. I love that. And that of course, reminds me of the story of Ruth. We see that in practice, don't we?
So one of the cool things here is that we see it's the poor and the stranger. So even if a stranger comes and he has some wealth, he wouldn't have been allowed to glean that field because he wouldn't have been invested in that field. So the way it originally would have worked is maybe, and you know, that's kind of happening these days. There are these kind of money funding sites where four or five people will get together and buy maybe a block of apartments. And then over time, they'll share the profits of that apartment. And that's what happens with these fields. You might get someone who couldn't afford a whole field, but a group of people might get together. And they then themselves would harvest that field and take a cut of it. But the stranger, and this is going to come up later on, it's been a pet thing of mine over the last few weeks, the word sojourn. But the stranger that lived within the gates of this community wouldn't have been able to harvest that field because even if they were very wealthy, they didn't have any investment in it. So it's not just the poor person here, but also the person that's new, that hasn't quite integrated to become Israel yet, but still needs to eat. And as you said, the Ruth idea, the Ruth link there is really strong. And what I loved about the Ruth story is that they bring her away from the edges. She's told that she can glean as if one of the people who invested in the field. I think that's beautiful.
Mm. Russ.
Deuteronomy 15 is comes to mind when we're talking about the poor. You know, this is probably one of my favorite chapters, especially when dealing with how we're to help others. You know, the Torah, you know, the promise of blessing is something that a lot of people really understand. But when you really get down to it, the Torah encourages not only, this idea of being blessed, but of blessing others. Deuteronomy 15 makes the point that there will be no poor among you. And then later in the same chapter, it says there'll always be poor among you. But the idea is always to reach your hand out to the poor. And I had in my notes the book of Job, chapter 31, beginning in verse 16. He says, if I have withheld anything that the poor desired, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone and the fatherless has not eaten of it, for from my youth the fatherless grew up with me as with a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing or the needy without covering, if his body has not blessed me, or if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I've raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall off from my shoulder, and let my arm be broken from its socket. Pretty strong words. In other words, he put everything into helping the poor. I think it's real important.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I like about these couple of verses here is that it's not, it may be regarded as a type of welfare perhaps, but it's not a handout. It's not going to the door of the poor and saying, oh, look, we kept some over for you. It's leaving a portion of the field so that if they so desire, they can come and glean it. They are the ones that glean. And there's a certain dignity that is afforded them in being able to do that because they're still working for their food. And I think that's a wonderful thing as well.
Mm. I do too.
Verse 11, you shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Ross.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's interesting that stealing and deceitful dealings go together. It's almost like a lot of times one leads to the other. You know, if someone steals, then quite often they feel compelled then to lie to cover it up. You know, it's like one sin piles on top of the other. And the fact that those come right there together associates them together. I think that's interesting as well.
Mm. In 1912, I'm looking at... where am I looking at? Bible.org. So in the text here, it says, do not swear falsely by my name. You will be desecrating your God's name. I am God. That's what it says. But when I look at the Hebrew, there's a little vav in front. So this is directly pinned to the previous verse.
Mm.
It's those little things are just missed in the English. And even though I don't really have any Hebrew. It's not fair to say I do, but just that little bit of knowledge that a vav is like a hook and it links to the previous to the next. It's really helpful when you're looking at verses like this because it gives you an extra piece of context.
You shall not cheat your neighbor nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shall fear your God. I am the Lord. It's kind of a funny thing to think about, Ross. If you curse the deaf, they're not going to hear you. Right. But if you put a stumbling block before the blind, they're definitely going to find out about it.
Yeah, that's, I know a lot of people have pointed this out in commentaries or whatever, but the rabbis would extend that, not just thinking of the physically hearing impaired, but they would take that to another level, and I think it's important. Don't even speak behind someone's back so that they can't hear. You know, it's really a great moral lesson. People could say, well, the text doesn't actually say that. It implies literal deafness. But think about the hurt. We'll get into some more of this as we go through. But when you talk about, if Jason called me and he told me some bad things about you when you couldn't hear it, the crime is the same. It's one who can't hear having things spoken against him. That's a heinous crime in God's world, I think. I think it's really, really bad.
What strikes me there as well is, yeah, we are told, and I've read a few commentaries that have said this is presumed to be a real life thing. So when it says do not curse the deaf, it means do not curse the deaf and do not place a stumbling block before the blind. But there isn't such a thing as a stumbling block. I mean, I think that this is meant to be a moral piece of advice and a moral statute. I think that this is more about the harm you can do yourself than it's the person that's the deaf person or the blind person. So if you're right, if I rang you and said, have you heard about this thing with Jono and rah, 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 I'm suffering because, you know, where's my heart at that point? And I'm projecting onto you that it's okay to do that. And that's damaging you. And I'm not saying that I haven't, you know, I absolutely have spoken about people behind their back. I'm a human being, but I know that that also is the wrong thing to do. And I try not to. But what I think what it was saying here is that the deaf person isn't going to suffer from this unless the person you're speaking to somehow affects their life. It's really you. And it says that you should be holy. And to achieve that holiness, to achieve that set apartness, you need to be different to everybody else. And something else on that, just getting quickly, it's quite interesting. When I was growing up, I actually thought that being a monk would be kind of a cool thing. The idea of living in a gated community and just living a life of prayer and craft and not having to deal with the outside world and that kind of quiet contemplation, I always thought that would be a really enjoyable...
That appealed to you.
Yeah, real satisfying idea of what life would be. I mean, that was before I realized what life was and all the,
you know. It was before you went through puberty, right?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Oh, no, you know, then you discover things like drink and video games and all these terrible hooks that it drug you away. But my point is, I thought that was a holy life. But as you go through this and you go through your Torah, you can't live a holy life if you're separated from everybody else. Because you're supposed to be elevating other people and helping other people.
Point. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. You shall do no injustice in judgments. You shall not be partial to the poor or honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, and nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Ross.
Yeah, that is just, there's so much in these verses. It's like every one of these. Yeah, you know, I was thinking earlier, this kind of repeats the point, but when you think about justice, this is all about not impeding justice. And how many times in Scripture do we read about that? All the way back in Genesis 18, Jehovah says that the way of Jehovah is basically justice and righteousness in the earth. So when you start thinking about justice, you know, and how the people of Israel are told, look, don't judge a person based on his standing in the community. Don't let that blind you. You have to seek justice, true justice. I just think that this is one of the main points in all of Scripture. Justice, justice shall you seek.
Jason.
One point, actually, when I was going through, actually, the Hertz commentaries as well, and I had, I'd gone through this particular, this little kind of, well, I don't want to say trinity, but these three lines before, especially regarding judging people and being a fair witness to people. And there's a line there about the poor person. Can you read that one again?
You shall do no injustice in judgment, nor shall you be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty.
Right, so we often hear about honoring the person of the mighty, right? You, you've gone to some work due, and your boss is there, and your boss says, you know, I'm about to fire Kevin, but don't tell him. And then you end up spending an hour talking about Kevin and all the bad things he's going to do. And then he tries to wheedle you in, and you end up embroiled in this thing, and you do it, and you think it's okay to do it because he's your boss. And we hear that a lot, that people pay their way out of criminal charges, or they bribe their way out, or they're fearful of a person in charge, so they lie on their behalf. But this starts off with that you can't do that the other way around either. You can't feel sorry. Like, if someone's robbed something from a shop and they're terribly homeless, you can't allow that theft to go ahead because they're poor. You have to, you know, it's equal weights and measures. Now, you can absolutely go and buy some stuff and give it to that poor person, but it's not okay to let them get away with that theft. I think every heart is should be measured not on the home that that heart lives in, but on the acts of that heart. And so, regardless of whether it's poor or rich, you have to treat that with the same measure as everybody else.
Sure.
One other point on this idea. Exodus 23 has some wonderful teachings along these same lines. Just a couple of passages, if I might, in Exodus 23:1. You shall not utter a false report. Put not your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shall you bear witness in a cause to turn aside after a multitude to pervert justice. Neither shall you favor a poor man in his cause. I mean, this idea, it's like, you know, justice is defined as right, upright behavior, if you will. But notice it's a very narrow walk, if you will. You know, you have to be careful. Don't favor on the side of the wealthy because he's wealthy, like he could buy your opinion. Nor are you to say, well, this guy's poor. He deserves the decision to go in his favor. It's justice. It doesn't matter who you are or where you're from. Justice is justice. I love that.
Let me see. Verse 17 is where we are. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear the sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love the Lord your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Jason.
How different is that to what we get told in church? You may have heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy, right? Love your neighbor. It doesn't occur at all in this whole Torah, hate your enemy. And even here, where I think the emphasis for this passage is that even if someone in your community, and we have to remember here that this is a community, this is Israel, you know, however many hundreds of thousands or millions of people it may have been, there's a boundary that is containing these 12 groups, and they are a community, and they might not have all got on. And the emphasis of this passage here is that even if you see someone that you don't like, that you have a disliking for, and they're in trouble, you don't let your anger or hate or want of revenge for that person get in the way of you helping them when they need you. And that's, you know, I think that's the emphasis, and that's the love thy neighbor. It doesn't mean you have to go around patting everyone on the back and throwing daisies. It means that you have to. I mean, imagine if God treated us this way. And I know I keep coming back to this theme, but to be honest, it's quite nice having so much airtime. You know, I am holy and you should be holy. And how often did God choose not to smite and choose to give people a chance? And even though he was angry with Israel, he helped Israel. And that's what love is. And that's what he's asking us to do with people that we might not necessarily choose to help.
Russ. So,
yeah, one thought that comes to mind, I think for those who grow up in the church, you know, you get this idea a lot of time, this maxim, this wonderful truth called the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself, is attributed to Jesus. And I think people, you know, they have this negative view of the Torah and this positive view of the Gospels or the Christian writings or whatever. But they fail to give credit where credit is due. In other words, this beautiful truth, this greatest truth, probably, you know, a lot of the rabbis would say that this is the Torah at its most, I guess, basic form, to love your neighbor as yourself. And it goes back to Moses. It goes back to God in this Torah portion, Kedushim. Hillel said it this way, whatever is hateful unto you, do it not unto your fellow. I think that's a great way to think about it. You know, it's really that, because how do you judge that? How do you know how to apply this? Well, it's very simple. If it's hateful to you, don't do it to someone else. That's one of the points of holiness.
Verse 19, you shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you. We've spoken about that before. Whoever lies kindly with a woman who is betrothed to a man as a concubine and who has not at all been redeemed nor given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging. I've got scourging in the New King James, but they shall not be put to death because she was not free. Ross, scourging.
Yeah, that's lashes. Yeah.
That's lashes, is it? What, yeah, a whipping?
I'm gonna read you what I've got in my translation.
Go on.
If a man lies carnally with a slave woman who is half married to another man, and she has not been redeemed or given her freedom, she must be physically punished. However, since she has not been freed, the two shall not be put to death. So this is an instance where you're, and it's interesting, this comes right after the you mustn't mix your livestock, you mustn't mix your seeds, and you mustn't mix your fabrics. And now we're saying that if you've got a slave woman, all right, so you can have some Hebrew slaves were allowed to marry other Hebrew slaves. It was not all of them, but some of them were. And if it was an understanding that was going to happen, and the owner of that slave woman had sex with her, even though she was due to go with another man, she would be physically punished and he would have to give an offering. I think that comes up in the next passage. But her physical punishment would be lashes. It wouldn't be death because she wasn't committing adultery because she wasn't married yet.
Now, that's interesting because in my New King James, it says, for this there shall be scourging, but they shall not be put to death. But what you're saying is the scourging is inflicted upon the woman.
Yeah, just the woman, not the guy. Yeah.
Ay, ay, ay.
I was just going to add that one of the notes in Hertz is sort of interesting. It's an example. It's interesting that this comes in context with talking about the mixing of different kinds of seed. And so the footnote in Hertz says we have an example here of prohibited mixture in the sphere of moral relationship. So it's like a physical and, you know, it's almost like something that goes beyond. I just think that's interesting the way that's worded. It's a prohibited.
So this would suggest, if I understand this correctly, then this is, and what you're saying, Jason, is that this is consensual on the woman's part.
Yeah, I believe so. I think if it was non-consensual, then we'd be reading the Torah relating to taking a woman against her will. Yeah.
Yes. Interesting.
It's not an easy read. I mean, I went through it a few times and I thought, how can this still be okay? I mean, why does she get punished and he doesn't?
Well, she's betrothed, you see. So
yeah, but still, he would have, I think, as the owner of that woman, because that's really what they're saying here. She was a slave to this person. I mean, a lot of the other commentaries I read say that she was a foreign slave, a Canaanite or something along those lines. But still, he's making a choice there to do something that would result in her being punished.
Mm-hmm. But there is a distinction being made, since it's not adultery since she's not married. I think that's your point, though. So there is a distinction being made there.
And he shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord, to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, a ram as a trespass offering. The priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering before the Lord for his sin which he has committed, and the sin which he has committed shall be forgiven him. When you come into the land and have planted all kinds of trees for food, and then you shall count their fruit as uncircumcised. 3 years it shall be as uncircumcised to you. It shall not be eaten. There's a reason for that. Guys, who wants to put up the hand for this one?
I'm going to read to you what I've got. When you come into the promised land and plant any tree-bearing edible fruit, you must avoid its fruit as forbidden growth. For 3 years, the fruit shall be forbidden growth. It may not be eaten. And the answers I've had for this, it's literally in the Hebrew, I think it's close to, you shall deem it uncircumcised. Now, I don't know if that means unclean, but what it does mean, you should ignore it, that it consider it forbidden for you, that it's rubbish to you. And I think this is just good farming advice. And often when we're outside of the law, when we're looking at how God deals with people, and some of the, you know, we get analogies of goats and sheep and livestock and wheat and barley and chaff and all this stuff, and it's all because these people were farmers. And I think that in this instance, it's just good advice that for the first 3 years you leave the tree to do whatever it wants, and then in the next verse, in the fourth year, its first fruits, if you like, are to be considered holy. They didn't eat it in that year either, but they did bring it, because this is in the land. This isn't out where they are. This is when they get to Israel. And so when that happens, they bring the fruit from these trees to the Creator as a thank you, you know. Then finally, in verse 25, in the fifth year, they get to eat. And it says there, and thus increase your crops. And the argument there is, there's a few arguments there. I think that when you start eating fruit, the tree delivers more fruit. I mean, that I think that's just a given. That's why a lot of the older, in the UK, there's been a decline over the last 50 years of ancient orchards. And when you don't harvest an orchard, the trees start to shrivel up and they don't produce as much fruit.
Right. Now, the reason for that, and I'm going to, so if I can just elaborate on what you've just said. What I think was the practice here is that in the first 3 years, they would prune the tree to prevent it from fruiting, because when a tree fruits, I mean, it puts an incredible amount of energy and strength into producing the fruit and putting all the, you know, to produce well-formed fruit, and it takes that energy and strength away from the actual plant itself. When you prune it and it's not trying to produce fruit, then all of that energy and strength, the nutrients, the moisture, goes into the strength of the plant. And you do that for the first 3 years, and what you have is a strong and healthy plant that by the time that it's that it's allowed to fruit, it's going to produce big, healthy, juicy fruit. And therefore, as you mentioned, Jason, in verse 25, that it may yield its strength to you, that it may yield to you its increase. I am the Lord your God. Ross, what do you reckon?
No, that's what I was looking at. It seems to be wrapped up in that last bit, that last statement, that its yield to you may be increased. Now, I don't know if it's a blessing because you've been obedient, or if there's something in the world of horticulture that I'm just not familiar with. But
I think it's pruning, yeah.
Yeah, maybe so. That's an interesting idea.
You shall not eat anything with the blood. You shall not practice divination or soothsaying. You shall not shave around the edges of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. Now, we've already read back here in verse 9 where it says, you shall reap the harvest of your land. You shall not wholly reap the corners of the field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of the harvest. These two, if I'm not mistaken, I think these two together are the reasons why some Jews have peyot, which is the locks on the side of the head. And it's a sort of a symbol to remind us to look after the poor, to not glean the sides, if you like, to not cut the sides, but leave that for the poor. But also they get it from here. You shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. You shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks on you. I am the Lord. Jason.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of interesting this, because there's a couple of arguments that I hear quite a lot pertaining to tattooing. that it's okay to get tattoos so long as you're not doing it in memory of the dead.
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just because we've done this before where I have to explain to everybody, that's not Jason flushing the toilet. That's Jason's... Do you want to just tell everyone what's going on?
That's what you get. All right. So at nighttime, because I'm in an apartment block, I'm three floors up. And at nighttime, and sometimes in the late afternoon, there's kind of this air bubble that comes up through the pipes. And it makes the sink gurgle in the kitchen. And yeah,
sounds that's like a flushing toilet.
Yeah, for the wasn't.
That's so funny. Now that we've cleared that up, please continue.
Right. So there's a couple of arguments. One is that you are given your body, and when it says don't make any gashes in your skin or do not tattoo your skin, that's it. And then there's a more literal one that says, well, there's a caveat to that, because it says do not make gashes on your skin for the dead. Do not tattoo marks on your skin for the dead. I am God. Now, it's worth remembering that at this point, Israel, I mean, this wasn't, 2015. This was thousands of years ago when Israel was a nation within many nations. And many of the commandments here were telling Israel not to act like the other nations. And so there were, and I'm trying to remember, it was the Amorites, so I'm pretty sure it's Nay. But there was another tribe that was very famous for when they lost somebody, they'd grieve by cutting themselves or by marking their skin with ink. And so, you could make quite a good argument that you can have a tattoo as long as it's not a remembrance of someone that's died. I'm kind of down the middle. I'm not really sure which way I go on this.
Well, I think you can be down the middle, I think, because I've heard a lot of very learned Hebrew teachers say that it can be read either way, that you shouldn't make any tattoo marks on your body for in memory of the dead, or you can read it as don't tattoo yourself. Mm. Either of those are quite legitimate. Do you have an opinion there, Ross?
Yeah, the first thing that came to my mind when you were talking about shaving the sides of the head and all, I was picturing Jason, had he gone the route as his younger self to be a monk, and how he would look if he had that, you know, that monk haircut where they do the... But no,
I can see it.
the tattooing, so this is something that came, you know, when I was young, I was in the military, and so I had this, you know, I'm an American, so I had an eagle with a tattered flag tattooed on my left arm, and you know, my wife told me at that time, oh, don't do that, you'll regret it later, but I wanted to be tough like all the other guys, like the nations, you know. Well, years later, I did think, you know, oh, man, I found this verse in the Torah, and it says not to tattoo myself, and I did this. And there is a remarkable teaching. I heard Tobias Singer one time. He was asked this very question. And one of the things he tells this story is only he can do. And in the story, he addressed it, and I'll mess it up, so I won't tell the story. But it was something to the effect that a person who had been in the Holocaust, who had his skin marked, was talking to someone who later got a tattoo. And the essence of the story was, you know, that tells of your past as this tells of my past. You know, we both can still live a holy life. So, you know, a lot of people have tattoos and they may feel guilt over it, but maybe that'll help someone.
And I have to admit, I like the way some tattoos look. There's some really beautiful artwork that goes into these. And, you know, I think that if in your heart you read this text that it's that this is specifically a remembrance of the dead, that because I can see God thinking that, you know, I can see him saying, I don't want you going around looking at your skin and thinking about these dead people. I mean, because we're getting this in the same batch that's just told us not to cut up in animals as to see omens and to look in portent for the future. And I imagine that there must have been an element of that you cut your skin because somebody you loved has died. And now when you look at that cut, you think of that person and you maybe get some help from that. If that's not your reason, but you have got a reason, I saw this, this might not be the time or place, but there was some really lovely photographs. That's probably totally the wrong phrase, but some women who have double mastectomies have full chest tattoos to cover up those scars. and to turn that area that was very feminine, that they now feel maybe they've lost, into something that they feel is beautiful again. And I find it hard to think that that's the wrong thing to do, that they are turning their body into something beautiful after something, a horrible experience has happened to them. And they're not doing it because they're remembering the dead. They're doing it because they're embracing life. And while I can see the text may be read that, you shouldn't tattoo your skin because of the dead, I can't see that you shouldn't tattoo your skin because of the living. And it's both ways, but I can totally see when people say, I wanted to get this done for years and it's important to me and it represents the love I have for a person or a thing or my life, or it's an experience I wanted to record on my body. I think, if you feel that strongly about it, you should just do it.
Having said that, Jason, I know that you share my dislike for needles, and yeah, the thought of having a whole batch of them concentrated in one area doesn't appeal to me. I'm not likely to ever be getting a tattoo, and I don't regret that.
I go to the school of Sharpie, where if I want a tattoo, I'm gonna draw it on with a felt tip pen and wash it off in a week.
Yeah.
So neither of you then have tattoos.
No, I don't have a tattoo.
No, so we're looking down on you right now.
Yeah, that's right. We're gonna be throwing things at you from the cable car when you're going up beside her.
That's right. Look, I was gonna ask you though, it says in verse 26, you shall not eat anything with its blood. Well, let me ask you this. What if your religion has this ritual where you play like you're drinking blood? It's not really blood, but they say it's blood.
Pretend blood drinking? Yeah. It's kind of creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if that, if it's not real blood, so I wonder if you could drink something and say it's blood. I don't do that.
Jason, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, we know where this is going. But what's kind of interesting is that when you do speak to a Christian about some parts of Christianity, so you say, Jesus, what was the point? And they'll say, well, Jesus died on the cross for the redemption and the forgiveness of our sins. And you'll say, well, where is that in the text? And they'll say, the Passover lamb. And you say, well, Jesus wasn't a lamb, and that the Romans weren't priests, and the cross wasn't the temple altar. And they'll say it symbolized that. Spiritually, it was that. But then when you go to something where explicitly it says, drink my blood, it's not saying, imagine this is my blood. It's kind of, and who's to say? I mean, he turned water into wine. We don't know. We don't know what they were drinking out of that cup. So I think it's interesting that they can pick and choose this symbolic element to this. While we're here as well, I do want to say, because in 1926, and it wasn't in your text that you read out, Jono, it says, do not act on the basis of auspicious times. That's the last line of 1926. So just to show a little bit of parity between... a little bit of a dig at Christianity. I watched a program on Chabad the other day where it was speaking about the understanding that there were some lucky days in Judaism, in the kind of spiritual side of Judaism, that some days are considered luckier than other ones to do certain things, that it's a blessing to do some things on certain days. And so what I'm looking forward to next week is to digging into that a bit more and seeing how that applies, given that it says here, do not act on the basis of auspicious times, which literally means do not believe in lucky days.
That'll be interesting. Ross?
On this idea of divination, soothsayers, auspicious times, it's interesting. This shows up in the prohibition list associated with holiness. And you recall in Isaiah chapter 8, I won't read it, but in Isaiah chapter 8, there's this idea, bind up the testimony, seal the teaching among my disciples. And that's contrasted with this idea of seeking after wizards that peep and mutter. There's a lot about this divination, soothsayers, and that sort of thing that's prohibited if you want to live a holy life.
Mm. Now, whose computer is making that noise?
It's probably mine. I don't have headphones. My computer's beeping.
What's it doing? What's it saying to you?
It's
not running out of batteries, is it?
No. It's all these people sending me hate mail, and I don't know what I can't turn it off. So you're like real picky. You won't let his sink gurgle. You won't let my email.
I'm a perfectionist.
It's a quality show.
It's a quality show. Now, moving on. Do not prostitute your daughter. Do not verse 29. Do not prostitute your daughter to cause her to be a harlot, lest the land fall into harlotry and the land become full of wickedness. As if that needs to be said, but I'm glad that it is. Yep. Verse 30.
Wait,
you shall keep my Sabbath.
No, we can't do that yet.
Do you want to jump over that? Okay.
Verse 19:29 says, do not defile your daughter with premarital sex. You will then not make the land. You will then not make the land sexually immoral, and the land will not be filled with perversion. So we're starting here with the premise that your daughter hasn't had premarital sex, and she is therefore as perfect as your daughter's going to be, and that you're.
Well,
left-
hang on, now that's a different thing, because I've got do not prostitute, which means, you know, oh look, sorry dear, we're running out of money, you're going to have to put you to work.
Maybe, and, but that's not what it says.
That's not what you've got. Okay, so Ross, how do you read it?
Well, it's literally in the Hebrew. No, you shall profane. The root word is halel. And no, you shall profane your daughter for harlotry.
Hmm. So it's not necessarily putting her to work, so to speak?
No, it's any kind of sex outside of marriage. But what's really lovely is it starts off with the premise that your daughter is perfect. Because it says, do not defile your daughter, or Ross says profane. And also the land. You will then not make the land sexually immoral. So the land isn't sexually immoral as it is. And you can do your bit by making sure you raise your kids right. I wish I could do that in an accent, but
that's close.
Right. No, I'm glad you stopped there and brought that up. You shall keep my Sabbath. This is the second time this has been mentioned. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Give no regard to mediums and familiar spirits. Do not seek after them to be defiled by them. Yeah, mentioned again, I am the Lord your God. You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man.
So if you
that'd be you, Russ.
You guys,
you're in the Bible.
You guys have to stand up. I'm the gray-headed man. That's what it says. There it is right there. Rise before the gray hair.
Remember that when we're on the tour on the bus.
I'm going to quote it like every time we get off the bus.
And fear your God, I am the Lord. And if a stranger dwells with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him. The stranger who dwells among you shall be to you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourselves. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
Can I jump in there quickly?
Yep.
So in the last week's Torah portion, well, actually this week's Torah portion this time around, because it's a double, and I did allude to the fact that this word sojourn has been on my mind lately for a number of reasons. I've got on my version that I'm reading off the computer here, when a proselyte comes to live in your land, do not hurt his feelings, which is kind of a nice, easy way of saying it. And then the next line, when a foreigner who becomes a proselyte, he must be treated exactly like one of those native and is born among you. You must love him as you love yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. Now, when Israel were foreigners in Egypt, they weren't necessarily strangers in Egypt, and it's difficult because we've got these different phrases of alien and foreigner and stranger, and different translations move them with different things. But when Israel was living in Egypt, it didn't become Egyptian. They were consistently Israelites. They might not have had the land, but they were Israelites. Now, when this foreigner sojourns within the gates, within the people, so they're living with Israel, they're doing everything Israel does. And it doesn't work. It doesn't. It's not a one-way street. They can't say, "Well, you know, your law there says I'm to be treated as a native born among you for this instance, but I want to eat that thing over there that's unclean." They can't do that. There's one law for the foreigner who lives, who sojourns within the gates, and for the native who's born among them. And I often wonder how that applies today. So I live in an apartment block. And aside from a neighbor who I found out was an Israeli, that's crazy as that, I don't think there are any other Jewish people in this apartment block. Now, I do choose to eat a biblical diet, and I choose to rest on the Sabbath, and I choose to live what I suppose would look like a Jewish lifestyle. Although if someone asks, I don't think I can pronounce myself Jewish until I've converted, or it's in this line here. And I'm a foreigner at the moment who is choosing to become a proselyte. That's kind of, for me, that's a bit of an issue that the sojourner is a person who's living within the community. Now, I do attend a synagogue, and moreover than that, I think, on a daily basis, I'm interacting with Jews online, and I kind of wrestle with, you know, does that count? Does that count as sojourning within the gates? And it's something I think everyone should spend some time with thinking about, especially when 4 or 5 years ago, when I read these passages or the end of last week's Torah portion, there are plenty of passages that say, and for the stranger that sojourns within the gates. Mm. And I, at that point, was wholly on board with the New Testament being a divine scripture, and Jesus was this Messiah, and that we should pray via Jesus. That was 5 years ago. And I saw myself not just as a stranger living within the gates, but the only person living within those gates. I didn't have any relationship with the Jewish people. I didn't have any understanding of a nation of Israel today. And I supplanted myself within that tribe and erased everybody else. I didn't sojourn within the gates. I built my own gates. I worshipped my own God in the way that I thought was right. And now I'm questioning, am I living within those gates? Should I be doing these things? And I think it's something that people should spend some time with, figure out what the text says and what they do. And if you can do more to interact. And we spoke about Ruth earlier, and I know I'm taking up time, but we spoke about Ruth earlier. And lots of people would say that, well, Ruth made this declaration, you know, your people should be my people. And bingo, she's Israel. But I don't read it like that. Ruth went to live with these people, and she hung back. You know, she didn't strut around saying, you know, give me this, give me that. She didn't assume that she could go and harvest with the people. She hung back because she was a stranger. She got to know everybody. A good report got sent to Boaz. And why would that even be necessary? She was a stranger who learnt the ways of those people. And yeah, it might not have been the conversion that often people go through now, but I definitely think there was a proselyte stage, a conversion stage where she became, where she integrated and lived within the walls of that community. And I might not be very, I mean, I might get a few unfriends on Facebook because of this. It's not a very, perhaps, I'm just, this is my opinion and not the opinion of Truth to You or the sponsors. But that's where I am now, and I wanted to share that because it has been on my mind. And I'm only speaking about myself, but it's something to think about. Can you interact with your Jewish community more than you are now? Even in a virtual way, people live all over the world, and I know people that live in the middle of forests or in Alaska. I mean, how are you possibly going to go down to your local synagogue when you live in Alaska? But if you've got an internet connection and you've got the option to, then, you know, get integrated with your Jewish community. If you want to be part of this Israelite nation, then be part of the Israelite nation. And that was, here endeth my rant.
Ross, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I was going to add, there's an interesting thing. I did not know this. You know, sometimes you study a lot and you think you have a lot of knowledge, and then you run across something. You know, this idea that when a person goes to convert, they're told no three times. That actually is based on, that tradition is based on Naomi. The story of Ruth. Yeah. So that's an interesting point. Another thing Jason has mentioned several times in this this particular Parsha is the idea of how prominent the idea of the stranger is. And in this particular passage in Leviticus 19:33 that says, you shall not wrong him, that idea comes up, according to Hertz, 36 times in Scripture. It's why it's such a, you know, it's so much on our mind when we read this. The other thing that I think about quickly is who is your neighbor? You know, if you go back to verse 19, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, you could get the idea that that means only an Israelite. But here in verse 34, it clearly describes something broader, like not even just Israelis, but your neighbor. Like, who is your neighbor? Like the famous story in the gospel writings. Exodus chapter 11, the neighbors That word is used for the Egyptians when they ask every man his neighbor, and the Egyptians gave to them. So the Torah really is not as restrictive as people might think. You can't just say, well, you're not my neighbor, I don't have to love you. Well, I think the Torah demands more of us than sometimes we want to admit, and that's borne out in this particular passage.
The last couple of verses in Leviticus 19, you shall do no injustice in judgments, in measurement of length, width, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, and honest ephah, and honest hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall observe all my statutes, all my judgments, and perform them. I am the Lord your God. Now here, this is the second chapter of this Torah portion. We're going to have to fly through this because we're running out of time. But it's the penalties for breaking the law. And it begins by saying, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, again, you shall say to the children of Israel, whoever of the children of Israel or of the strangers who dwell in Israel, who gives any of his descendants to Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I will set my face against that man. I will cut him off from his people because he has given some of his descendants to Molech to defile my sanctuary and profane my holy name. And if the people of the land should in any way hide their eyes from this man when he gives some of his descendants to Molech, and they do not kill him, then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut him off from his people and all who prostitute themselves with him to commit harlotry with Molech.
Molech was one of these great, and I'm not sure if it's Canaanite.
Ammonite,
right. So he's a... oh, right, and the Ammonites were the same ones that cut themselves when they were grieving. That's the AO I was trying to think of. And there was a lot of blood with this. They literally killed their children in the arms of this big statue, this stone statue, as an offering, as a sacrifice. I mean, it's real pagan stuff. It's quite nasty. But what I take from this, and what's really interesting for me, is that you've got Moses and Aaron and the priests and the fire and the smoke and the tabernacle and the ark and all this amazing stuff. And there are still people within this boundary who are sneaking off to kill their children to this foreign stone god. And they're doing that and coming back. And not only do they include themselves as Israel, no, they consider themselves Israel, even though they're doing this, but there are people who allow that to happen, that turn the blind eye for whatever reason, through the love of the person, because through fear, but don't want to be attached. But they're allowing that that evil, that wickedness, if you like, to sponge into their lives.
Yeah, yep. And it's interesting that God says, you know, if you do this, that's it. You're facing the death penalty. And if you see someone doing it and you don't say anything, you're in just as much trouble.
Yeah, there's a responsibility not only to not do it, but to not let others do it around you. You have some responsibility there. So one other thing, Molech is the title of the Ammonite god. Notice that it's related in Hebrew. It's the same consonants as Moloch, to rule, to reign. So it says, this footnote here says, the worshippers of this god were accused of child sacrifice. It's the title king of the Ammonite god.
Horrible. And the person who turns to mediums, again, Ross, it's here, the person who turns to mediums and familiar spirits to prostitute himself with them, I will set my face against that person and cut him off from his people. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy. I am the Lord your God, and you shall keep my statutes and perform them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. For everyone who curses his father or mother, he shall surely be put to death. And that's pretty much where we started in verse 19, chapter 19, and it's reiterating it again here. He has cursed his father or his mother, his blood shall be upon him. The man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he who commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. The man who lies with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness. Both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon him. If a man lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They have committed perversion. Their blood shall be upon them. If a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. If a man marries a woman and her mother. Ugh.
What a crazy man that is. There's a crazy,
what a crazy man.
You know,
what's going on, dude?
I'm thinking it's a good job they didn't have Jerry Springer around at this point, because I remember watching Jerry Springer when it was on TV like 10 years ago, and any one of these could have been that program, you know, with they weed out these people and I'm in love with my sister's dog's friend's cousin. And that's exactly what's going on here. But so anyway, the stoning here is important. Stoning was a community thing. Often, you know, you come across, and it's difficult. You know, it is difficult. We live in a world where we don't want to. I mean, it seems so harsh. You know, it's difficult for us. And when you come across people who say, you know, how can you condone stoning? And you know, I can't condone stoning, but I can't not condone it either. It's just God's rules. He gets to choose. But stoning was done. It was very public. It was a way of showing people what will happen to you. It wasn't meant to be something that would be repeated over and over again. I think if you watched one stoning, that would be enough to make you realize that marrying a woman and her mother wasn't a good idea, how you could ever think it would be. It's worth remembering that stoning was meant to be, I mean, it could be, if it just said death, it should be put to death, you know, and they're drowned or poisoned or something in a room and no one can see, that'd be one thing. But this was meant to be a public spectacle that stopped, like the guy that picked up the sticks on the Sabbath. You don't hear that story repeated over and over and over and over again. It's a one-time deal, because after that first time, no one's going to do it.
It's a hear and fear situation. And this is very much a reiteration of chapter 18, pretty much altogether. It goes on to say in verse 22, "You shall therefore keep all my statutes and my judgments and perform them, that the land where I am bringing you to dwell may not vomit you out." And last Torah portion, Tovia made mention of this and talked about how if these were to persist, that the land will literally spit you out. And of course, that's what happened to us first with Israel, with the altars of Bet El and Dan, and then eventually to Judah as well, because of the idolatry that we fell into.
And we're going to go there. By the way, we're going to go there to that altar at Dan. I've been there.
We are.
It'd be incredible. You want to go there? Let's go there.
We're definitely going to be there. And it goes on to say, "And you shall not walk in the statutes of the nations which I am casting out before you, for they committed all these things, and therefore I abhor them," is what I've got, which is so heavy. "But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you as a possession, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the people." There's the holiness. "I have separated you from the peoples." Why? Because of your conduct, because of the Torah which I have given you. "You shall therefore distinguish between clean animals and unclean, between unclean birds and clean, and you shall not make yourselves abominable by beast or by bird or by any kind of living thing that creeps along the ground. I have separated from you as unclean, and you shall be holy to me, for I am the Lord. I am holy, and I have separated." I love the repetitive use of the word "separated" here. "I have separated you from the peoples, that you should be mine." A man or a woman, and this is, again, Ross, here we are again, and this is the way that our Torah portion ends. "A man or a woman who is a medium or who has familiar spirits shall surely be put to death, and they shall stone them with stones, that blood shall be upon them." Reminds me, of course, of the story with Saul, his desperation, when God refused to speak with him, and he consulted a medium even after he attempted to have them eradicated from the land. Ross?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add. Did you notice there, when we talk about holiness, I grew up with a tradition that said that the kingdom of God is not food and drink. And yet here in this particular passage, as well as Deuteronomy chapter 14, there is an association between holiness and diet. And I think that people sort of minimize that. But when you really think about it, there truly is this association. And, you know, we started off talking about the center of the Torah. You know, we talked about the center word. We talked about the center book. Did you know the center letter, you got to get this, the center letter was in last week's Torah portion, Leviticus 11, verse 42, and it's the vav in the word gachon, which means belly, and it's talking about the dietary rules. So it's interesting that once again,
that is interesting.
You have the very heart of the Torah is associated with diet. go back to the very beginning, Jono and Jason. Think about it. The very first mistake is a violation of diet. So I would argue that diet is much more important than what people would credit it, you know, in terms of holiness. I mean, this is the chapter on holiness, the section on holiness, and it ends with an affirmation of eating the right things.
Jason.
You know what strikes me is interesting there? I mean, Ross, you just said that we come from a tradition which says it's not what goes into your mouth that makes you unclean. And then I remember the story of Peter and the vision, where he says, I've never eaten an unclean thing. And I find that it's kind of interesting that Peter, who was a Jew, I mean, maybe not a wholly religious Jew, we don't really know, but I'm assuming he's just kind of the casual laborer guy who happened to be Jewish and lived what would have then been a very normal Jewish life. His understanding of that was that if you eat unclean, you're unclean. And if you eat clean, you're clean. So much so that he shouts that out. I've never eaten an unclean thing. And that's 2,000 years ago. You know, that understanding was still prevalent in the land. And so why should it be any different now? I mean, that's from a book which, I mean, I wonder sometimes why they left some of this stuff in. You know,
yeah,
it's very, I mean, surely you'd gone, well, you know, I kind of don't want them to keep all these kosher laws because, you know, I'm doing a good line in bacon at the moment, but they left it in. But there we are. I agree with you completely. I think that there's something that happens to you when you start keeping a biblical diet. And spiritually, there's something that happens to you. And mentally, there's something that happens to you because you start taking care and thinking about all of your actions.
That's right.
My wife's vegetarian, and she'll check everything anyway. Right. So, you know, you pick up something, it's like a yogurt, and you look underneath to see what type of gelatin it has in it. But, you know, for me, that was something I never bothered with. Or I'd say, like, I'm going to get this candy, and you can't get that. It's got pork in it. I'm like, it's candy. How can it have pork in it?
Isn't it amazing? And as soon as you start to keep a biblical diet, you very quickly find out what it means to be separated from the people.
Right.
Ross, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, that passage that that Jason mentioned is one of the passages that a lot of Christians will use to say, oh, look, I can eat anything now. And you're like, well, read it in context, because Peter is troubled with this vision, if I recall. He's like, I don't even know what this means. I've never eaten anything unclean. And he says that the vision was to teach him that God doesn't make distinctions between persons. So what you do then is you can tie that to this chapter. Notice you brought it up, Jason. It's like Leviticus is full of distinctions between this and between that and between holy and profane. But Jehovah says very clearly that the people, in other words, don't distinguish. There's one law for the foreigner, the stranger, as well as the native. And I think it's important that people, even if they're still within that tradition and they still cling to Acts chapter 10 as a reason that they're eating unclean foods, go read it in context. And one final point on diet, you know, I tell people all the time, if you go back to the garden story, who was it that sort of put this idea in our head that we can eat whatever? Hath God said? So I tell people all the time, the voice of the snake still comes out in the mouth of preachers when they tell you can eat whatever. Because the first voice that said you can eat anything goes back to the serpent in the garden. So quit listening to snakes. Eat holy foods.
There it is. Stick with the Torah, and that is our Torah portion. Any final thoughts, Jason?
No, only that it's now bedtime. It's definitely bedtime.
It is. I keep forgetting it's now 3 a.m. for you. Better let you go to bed. Thank you, Jason's Spiritual Babies of spiritualbabies.net, Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org, Ancient Truth for a Modern World. My friends, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You for Torah Bells.
Thanks for having us.
In the meantime, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart, be holy, as our God is holy, by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.